Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin, and with me is my co-host, Barry Rose, every woman's dream, every man's nightmare. Barry, how you doing?
Good God, that was a good one. I'm doing great. We are recording live. You are listening to a live recording right now, so I'm super excited, too, and I know that you and I, you know, we've been talking off air about this episode for the last couple of weeks, and you were like, I'm going to pull the trigger. Let's make this happen, and here we are today. So I'm pretty excited.
And on this show, we are going to break kayfabe. Aha! Going to stop right there because my wife, the lovely Mrs. Bowdrin, actually sat and told me, you need to warn your audience that this episode is going to be wrestling intensive. We are going nonstop entirely about wrestling. So we're not going to break kayfabe on life today. We're going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. I'm waiting for those going to break kayfabe on life t-shirts that were recommended on our new board. So we're going to talk exclusively today about our favorite and our choices for best tag teams of all time in toto. Barry, I know you, much like myself, are prepared for a rather lengthy episode today.
Yeah, so we should actually say this is going to be the six-hour Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry episode. But you know what? If you had to have a six-hour episode and you're removing food, nudity, tag team wrestling should be the subject matter, correct?
I would wholeheartedly agree. Let me just clarify for everyone before you get a deep dive into our show here. We're going to exclusively talk about our favorite tag teams of all time. That is going to be the entire length and breadth of this episode. I'll tell you how it started, folks. I saw on Twitter, I don't even remember who the gentleman was. Someone had posted a fantasy tournament of tag teams on Twitter, I believe, and he had 64 teams. And when I first saw the list, I have to be honest with you, I kind of started laughing because, among other things, he had Rick Steamboat and Jay Youngblood losing in the first round, which immediately started me laughing. He had some other teams that were on there that I thought perhaps were not teams that I would have included in the 64 greatest tag teams of all time. You know, teams like the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff. Yeah, they had a hell of a run of popularity. You know, Eddie Gilbert and Sting. Not choices that I would have made. Again, a good team, but top 64 of all time. And, you know, Barry and I sat down and we were talking about some of the teams on this list. And I said, yeah, you know, these guys are good teams. But are they really one of the 64 best tag teams of all time? So that's sort of the basic genesis of our episode today. So what we're going to do, basically, you know, Barry and I have talked before about how a lot of times our phone conversations sound exactly like one of our podcasts because it's just us getting on the phone and we sit there and start kind of shooting the breeze and one thing leads to another and we're on the phone for an hour. Am I right, Barry?
Yeah, exactly. I think I use a little more profanity in our private conversations and a little less here. You're pretty good about that, actually. But yeah, so when you actually reached out to me first off, and this, I don't even know if this was even the idea of the show at this point, but you said, have you seen this graphic that this guy put up for the greatest of all time tag team tournament? And I said, no, I haven't. You forwarded it to me. And I think the first thing I said to you, I said, the Young Bucks beat the Briscoe brothers? What the fuck?
I think that was after you first said, ugh.
I think you're right.
So what we're going to do is we're just going to start riffing on teams that we think were all-time great tag teams. We're going to finish up the show by each offering our top 10 choices for the best tag teams of all time, top 5 underrated tag teams of all time, and we'll throw in a couple of teams that we feel are among the most overrated tag teams of all time. I know what people are thinking about right now. I have a history with one tag team, and everyone's going, oh, yeah, I know Badrin's going to riff on the Road Warriors now. I'm not going to say. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. Maybe you'll have to listen to the end of the show. I will say we'll also offer some choices from friends of ours, their picks for the top choices for most underrated tag teams. We went in the business, outside the business, and we wanted people to give their opinions and offer them up. So let's start off, Barry. We'll start off in Florida since that's where you and I both got our start pretty much in the wrestling business. Tell me if you remember who the first tag team that you really got into was.
Oh, the first tag team that I really got into? I do. It's actually on my underrated list. Should I go ahead and make the reveal right now?
Give us one from your most underrated list.
Absolutely. So it's a team called the Masked Superstars. And it was 1975, and all of a sudden this team showed up, had never seen these guys before. It was two guys underneath the mask, hence the Masked Superstars. And they had a manager named Sam Bass, and this was a team that was coming from the Memphis, Tennessee area. And they were really unique, and it was a different style of wrestling, and I was like, I was just blown away by these guys. So they were horrifically underrated. They got a big push in the beginning. They were feuding with Eddie and Mike Graham, and if you got into a feud with Eddie Graham in Florida, there was always a reason. You know, Eddie believed in you. Eddie wanted to see you get over. So they were in a feud with the Grahams. They feuded with the Negro Brothers, which was Cyclone and Omar Negro, which a fantastic team. And then they kind of fizzled out. And, you know, the Masked Superstars never got a run with the Florida tag titles. And their stay probably lasted, I don't know, 4 months, maybe 5 months. But, again, they were doing stuff from a tag team standpoint that was really highly unique to me. And a lot of it had to do with the interaction of Sam Bass as well. Because, you know, unfortunately, he died a year later, 1976. So he never – his exposure was limited. But what a unique guy. And I told this story – on Jimmy's show, Jim Cornette's show, and he asked me a question. He goes, when was kayfabe broken for you? So I can clearly tell you that all these men that I just mentioned were absolutely responsible for breaking kayfabe. There was a match one night at the Miami Beach Convention Center, and it was Cyclone or Omar Negro versus the Masked Superstars. And the Masked Superstars were originally Jerry Lawler and veteran Don Green, and with Sam Bass, obviously. And down the road, Lawler left. Carl Von Steiger came in. They did an eventual unmasking on television, and Von Steiger got the mask ripped off. But even Rip Hawk, for a short amount of time, had actually worn the mask. But getting back, so this match took place. Sam Bass came in the ring. He took off his cowboy boot. He hit Omar Negro over the head, and Omar did a blade job about 2 feet off the mat in clear view of everybody sitting in the first 20 rows. And I got to tell you, as an 11-year-old kid, and we're talking, this is almost 43 years later, I'm still a little devastated by it. I clearly remember seeing it. Everybody had told me, you know, wrestling isn't real and all that. And I said, oh, no, it's real. I go every week and I see the blood and these guys are really beating the shit out of each other. And I defended it. And I sat there that night and I watched him blade himself. And I was really, as an 11-year-old kid, I was kind of devastated. So kayfabe was broken for me in the summer of 1975. But that being said, the Masked Superstars were fantastic. They were underrated. I believe there's one match out there. It's on YouTube. It's the Masked Superstars against another team, which is not really a team. But, my God, Billy Robinson and Tony Charles. I mean, that to me is the ultimate, you know, working team right there. So that's my first from the underrated was the Masked Superstars, and probably the first team that made this massive, massive impression on me.
Yeah, you know, first of all, before I go any further, let me just say, I sat down and just started writing down names of great tag teams. And after I got through three pages, I figured I'm up around 60, 75 great tag teams. And I started thinking to myself, you know, there's going to be somebody I leave off this list. So don't take it personally, folks, if the tag team that you're thinking of as the greatest tag team of all time is not mentioned here. Because you know what? We could go back into the 50s and talk about, you know, Jerry Graham and Eddie Graham. We could talk about Antonio Rocca and Miguelito Perez or Miguel Perez. You know, somewhere we have to have a little cut off here. So I'm going to throw out lots of names here, and so is Barry. But, you know, if we forget your team, because one of the things on the tournament that the guy provided, I actually, because I've mentioned a few times, I am not someone that watches a lot of today's product. And there were some teams listed, and I actually texted Barry, who the hell are these guys? And I have to do a Google or something like that. And I go, oh, okay, these guys. And so I knew who the names were, but it's not a team necessarily that I spent a lot of time watching because quite frankly, other than New Japan and the occasional view of the WWE, I don't watch a lot of TNA. I don't watch a lot of ROH. I know, you know, a lot of people are big fans of the product. I don't go to the indie matches in the area anymore. So trust me, I'm not going to be discovering any team at a local independent card. But so that being said, and with those parameters, I'm going to just start throwing out some names of teams that I wrote down on my list as great teams. Okay. Some of them are great teams that people don't think of automatically as a great team. Like, here's one, Bobby Eaton and Coco Ware. Bobby Eaton and Coco Ware had a tremendous run. I want to say around 81, 82, 83-ish in Memphis, somewhere in that time frame. And a lot of people thought they were one of the most underrated tag teams of all time. I believe we had a match with the PYTs as one of my top 100 of the 80s. And Barry, you mentioned that Coco, when he was younger, before he went and became the Birdman, he not only had one of the great drop kicks in wrestling, but was really a good performer.
Yeah, you know, you've got a fantastic memory because we did that about a month ago, and I can't remember shit from yesterday. So I kudos for you on that one. But, yeah, he really was. You know, Coco was one of those guys, and unfortunately, you know, or maybe this is fortunate, when you're old like I am, you saw a lot of these guys. You know, I'm in my 50s. Jeff, you're in your 50s. And really, everybody cool is in their 50s at this stage. But
truly, truly, that's absolutely 100% accurate.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, 50 is the new 50, absolutely, from what I've been hearing. But Coco was one of those guys that we saw when he first broke in the business in the Memphis area. And the evolution of Coco between what he first was when he broke in, when he became probably one of the top performers in the business within the first three or four years of his career, one of the best drop kicks I think I've ever seen, though. I fully agree with that.
Yeah. So like I said, you know, Bobby Eaton is one of those guys. Bobby Eaton's been with seemingly 10 great tag teams. If you're going to put a guy in a Hall of Fame, you know, not even for one specific team, just for being a tag team wrestler, Bobby Eaton would have to be in that Hall of Fame because he's been with some amazing teams, much like his partner in one of those teams, Dennis Condrey. Think about how many great tag teams Dennis Condrey has been in. Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton, the Midnight Express that had the big run, 85, 86, I believe into early 87 before Dennis basically walked away from the company because of some personal issues. But how great were those guys? I said 85. How about their time in Mid-South feuding with the Rock and Roll Express? That stuff was absolute gold.
Yeah, so you're 100% right. Bobby Eaton, Dennis Condrey, obviously, as a team, were fantastic, but they both, before they got together and even afterwards, they both were part of great tag teams in general. I would fully agree with that. Steve Kern's another guy. Stan Lane, the Fabs. They, you know, Steve Kern was a part of two or three great teams. Stan Lane, not just the Midnight Express, not just the Fabs, but part of a great team with Brian St. John in Florida in 1979.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, as I'm just scrolling down my list here, I'm going to start off with one of the teams that I talked about. You know, I discussed when I was talking about the Road Warriors on the 605 podcast one night with Brian. Brian asked me about what I felt about the Road Warriors. And one of the things I said about the Road Warriors, and I really want people to understand the context which I'm saying this, the Road Warriors, I thought, were a great act. I'm going to give you an example of another team that was a great act, the Freebirds. Were the Freebirds the greatest tag team of all time? No, they were a really good team, don't get me wrong, but they were more than just a team. They were an act, and that's what made the Freebirds great. That's what made the Road Warriors great in their own way, was they were an act, that they were a spectacle. You know, the playing the Black Sabbath intro song, they'd come in, they'd chase all the heels out of the ring. That was a spectacle, and it got over really well. My problem with the Road Warriors was I just did not feel that, you know, I'll give you an example. We talked last week about Briscoes and Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis in a tag team match. I'm sorry, I don't think the Road Warriors are as good as the Briscoe brothers or Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch. You know, that's, you understand what I mean, Barry?
Yeah, well, they're not. So you're preaching to the choir right here, because they're not even remotely even close to it. You go back and you watch that match, and honestly, people that watched that match and then commented on the YouTube video, everybody was kind of blown away by the quality of that match. And then anybody that saw Adonis and Murdoch in person, or even through the magic of video and YouTube, all said the same thing. My God, these guys were good. They were good. You're 100% right about the Road Warriors. barriers. And you know, I don't want to get into the overrated thing, because if we go down that path right now, I'm going to start laying it out. But you know, you're right. And the Freebirds also, and I like the Freebirds more than I like the Road Warriors, because, you know, who didn't do the Michael Hayes strut to Bad Street when they were younger? We all did, right? Tell me. Of course we all did. The Freebirds were great. Terry Gordy was at a different level. Michael Hayes had the perfect role in the Freebirds. That was the whole thing. Buddy Jack Roberts, a guy who was, you know, part of tag teams also prior to even getting with the Freebirds. You know, he was one half of the Hollywood Blondes, which is just a tremendous tag team with Jerry Brown. So, you know, the Freebirds were great. And the Road Warriors, too. There was a place for the Road Warriors. They were revolutionary in what they did. But you know, there was a different impact on me, and they didn't have that. And I could say, you know what, if I started watching wrestling around 1983, and maybe the first thing I ever saw was the Road Warriors, maybe in my mind I'm saying, this is the greatest tag team I ever saw. That being said, you know, I think partly, and when you showed me this graphic, and I was blown away by the graphic, and really not in a good way, and you know, one of the matches I saw, and this is really the point I'm trying to make, which is long-winded as usual. So the first round has Bockwinkel and Stevens. So pure class Nick Bockwinkel, the crippler Ray Stevens faces the outsiders, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, and Bockwinkel and Stevens lose to Kevin Nash and Scott Hall. Now, I don't give
a fuck. Hold on, Barry, just 1 second. I think I just threw up in my mouth a little bit.
Okay, somebody get this man something to drink. Get him a barf bag.
Somebody get me a doctor.
Get him a doctor. And, you know, I don't care. And this is a conversation I've had with my wife. Well, I'm like, did you ever see this movie? And she goes, well, I was only 11 when it came out. Well, I don't know what that means. Have you ever seen The Godfather? Have you ever read the Bible? The Bible's what, 3,000 years old? I mean, you know, the point I'm trying to make is, in what fucking fantasy world do you live that you could put Kevin Nash and Scott Hall over Bockwinkel and Stevens? You don't. It makes no sense to me. So the guy that created this graphic, more power to you. It's a beautiful graphic. It's very, very pretty. You've got belts there, and you've got all this bracketing, but you don't know your history. You have no idea who Bockwinkel and Stevens are if you're having them job to the first round to Kevin Nash and Scott Hall.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing about the graph, and of course, by the time this comes out, we will post it on our Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry site. The thing that's interesting is he has these teams in here, and you sit there and you go, what the hell are these two doing? And any kind of list of the top, you know, 64 tag teams in theory of all time. And then you have somebody and you'll go, oh, that's kind of neat that he actually remembered that team, you know? And that's what kind of made the tournament so unique, is that he'll sit there and do something and you'll go, oh my God, this guy does absolutely not understand pro wrestling and what it's all about. And, you know, like he has, for instance, here's another first round, Tatsumi Fujinami and Kingo Kimura. I've seen them live, folks, in 1987. They were an amazing tag team that he has losing to the New Day in the first round. Okay. Now, I got to be honest with you. I said I'm not a huge tag team, you know, or I'm not really a big watcher of today's product. I've heard a lot of things about the New Day, that they're a great act. Okay. I don't know if they go over Tatsumi Fujinami and Kingo Kimura in any rational. And let's be honest, the way we're talking about this, you have to think about the way a booker would think. Okay. And, you know, or the way that someone who really studies, you know, the way that someone works. And I just don't see Tatsumi Fujinami and Kingo Kimura losing to the New Day in the first round. But, you know, then he includes a team like JYD and Mr. Olympia. How long were they a tag team in Mid-South? For like 3 months? Why are they in a list of the great 64 tag teams of all time? And I guess that's really what started the whole process of thinking about this. So, and you know, as a matter of fact, we just got done talking about the Freebirds, and we're kind of bounced back and forth here. I'll drop a little bit of a pearl of wisdom for you. I'm not sure that the Freebirds were Terry Gordy's best tag team that he was involved with.
Oh, I agree.
I'll tell you a team that history has forgotten. A lot of people remember Terry Gordy with the Freebirds. A lot of people remember Terry Gordy in Japan teaming with Steve Dr. Death Williams as part of the Miracle Violence Connection. do a little research and look up on YouTube Terry Gordy and Jimmy Snuka. That was a tag team. They were absolutely unbelievable. Barry, I know you remember their time on Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Yeah, and they were actually the highlight of that era of watching Georgia Championship Wrestling, which was a great show. That was a fantastic team. The only reason I would disqualify them would be length of time, that they weren't together for too long. But the Miracle Violence connection, oh, my God. That's where I thought you were initially going to go. So, hey, in looking at this graphic, and you just mentioned – so, yeah, sometimes you do have to look at things with a Booker mentality. For you, it comes natural, obviously. I mean, your name is the Booker. But, you know, not every fan is going to do that. And I can cut them some slack. But he's got a match on here that I just, for the life of me, you talk about, my mind is blown. Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher. So I really want everybody to close their eyes for a minute and visualize this. He's got Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher against Pentagon Jr. and Phoenix, with Pentagon Jr. and Phoenix going over. Now, that being said, I think Pentagon Jr. and Phoenix are probably the more entertaining and better team. But could you imagine in any world that Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher would be in the ring with two guys like Pentagon Jr. and Phoenix?
I would like to have been in the locker room that night when they would go into Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher and say, you guys are losing to the Mexican guys.
the 180-pound Mexican guys. Yeah. You're losing to them tonight.
So let me just continue running down my list of names here, and we'll get a little conversation going on them. The Hollywood Blondes, Brian Pillman and Steve Austin. Great team, didn't last a super long time, but while they were together, they were the best part of WCW during the run.
Oh, they were absolutely fantastic, and they were the best part. And I think the only negative there was that their run was also cut way too short. And I think as much as Stone Cold took off in the WWE, and he revolutionized between he and The Rock. You know, that was the next coming of professional wrestling in a sense. My favorite Stone Cold was his team with Pillman, just unbelievable.
And who can forget the Flair for the Gold, that great skit they did, you know, where they were mocking Flair and Anderson. That was really good stuff. Okay, so now let's talk about some great teams from Florida during Barry's formative years as a wrestling fan. I'm going to throw three teams out at you that I thought of that were all three dynamite teams. Mike Graham and Steve Kern, Masa Saito and Akiya Sato, and Bob Roop coming to the Fan Fest on June 2nd. And Bob Orton Jr., three great Florida tag teams. Barry, tell us what you remember about those three teams.
Yeah, and the first thing I got to say, so it wasn't Akiya Sato. This was the guy who later became Kabuki. Akiya Sato was this other wrestler, which was, I think, primarily Central States. But this was somebody completely different.
But weren't they referred to as Sato and Saito?
Oh, no, he was still Sato.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this wasn't Akiya.
That's where
Akiya
I made my mistake. I apologize.
Yeah, Akiya was the guy that was in Central States forever. So is this where I start to talk about my top 10 list? I mean, is this where, because this is right there. So the three teams that you just mentioned are all three in my top 10. There's no, and I have others that are there, but these three really, really were fantastic. Graham and Kern, and here was the thing. Graham and Kern, Mr. Saito and Mr. Sato and the Briscoe brothers literally for a year put on wrestling matches like you'll never see again. They're up there with the Briscoes, Adonis and Murdoch. These matches were that good. Mr. Saito and Mr. Sato may have been the greatest tag team that literally, if you didn't live in Florida, you never saw them. They were that good. The beauty of this was Florida was such a hotbed. People talk about Memphis being the tag team territory, and it was. It absolutely was. But Florida in the 70s was at a different level than I think any other territory in the United States. And I say that, so Mr. Sato and Mr. Saito, the first team that came in, and this came in 1977, was Ivan Koloff and Pat Patterson. So Koloff and Patterson came in, they were quickly put together, and they kind of dominated the state. Koloff was the Southern heavyweight champion. Pat Patterson was the Florida TV champion, and collectively they became the Florida Tag Team Champions. And they were a phenomenal team. They had a falling out. Patterson turned babyface. He left within 2 weeks and he moved on. And Koloff then formed a team with Mr. Saito. They then won the Florida Tag Team titles. So Koloff went from Patterson to Saito. Well, Koloff and Saito, they stayed together for a while. This was a team also. You just imagine Ivan Koloff in his prime with Mr. Saito. And I have this thing that I refer to in the CWF archives group as there's great and then there's Mr. Saito great. Mr. Saito in his prime was as good as anybody out there. Could have been a world champion in the NWA. I know he was world champion in the AWA 10 years later, but in 1977 and 78, Mr. Saito was mind-blowingly just an amazing, amazing wrestler. So you went from Koloff to Patterson to Koloff to Saito. They split up. Saito, within 2 weeks, hooks up with Mr. Sato. I mean, you're talking three great tag teams in a row right here. You throw in the Briscoe brothers, you throw in Graham and Kern, and you've just got 2 years of the best tag team wrestling in the country. It has never been duplicated. It never will be duplicated. Don't think for 1 second that I don't know how fortunate I was to see that, because it wasn't lost on me then, and it's not even lost on me now. The other team that we talked about briefly, which was Rupin Orton Jr., was kind of just before this, took place before all this actually happened. And Rupin Orton Jr. were fantastic. And this was Bob Orton's kind of ascension to the next level. He had never gotten a push like he got in Florida. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks back, but Bob Orton Jr. came in late 75 to Florida, and he was put with Carl Von Steiger. And Von Steiger had just been unmasked as one of the masked superstars, so he was kind of in line for a little bit of a push. They put them together, but it was clear that Orton Jr. was at a completely different level. Von Steiger was going to be more of a mid-card guy, maybe even a prelim guy. Orton Jr. was destined for the main events. So they give Orton Jr. the Florida title. They give him one half of the Florida tag team titles with Roop, and he kind of just dominated the state. You know, he kind of just took over. But the chemistry between Roop and Orton Jr. was, and there's a great story which I'll tell a little bit later as we get into this, but they were at a different level. These guys were competing, and there was a great storyline, and they had several great storylines with Roop and Orton Jr., but Bob Orton Jr. actually relinquished the title and gave it to his father, and then Roop and Orton Sr. became a team, and they were a great team as well. And even though Orton Sr. at this point was probably in his late 40s and definitely towards the end of his career, you got a guy that, you know, who understood professional wrestling better than Bob Orton Sr. So you put him with Roop, who's still in his prime, still a fantastic worker, and we're seeing four-star matches every night. It's just, you know, just fantastic. So I could go on, you know, obviously Florida's kind of my wheelhouse, but I could go on about tag team wrestling in the state of Florida, and this would be a, you know, a 20-part, two-hour show that, you know, we could do for the next 6 months.
So let's talk about a guy, we spoke about Bobby Eaton being a guy that had a run of great tag teams. Dennis Condrey, a guy that had a run with great partners as part of great tag teams. Here's another one, Stan Lane. Stan Lane with Steve Kern, the Fabs, tremendous run as part of the Fabs. He had a great run with Bobby Eaton as part of the Midnight Express. And he had a great run in Smoky Mountain with Tom Pritchard as his tag team partner. You know, one thing I remember about that just absolutely slayed me when it happened is I remember, Barry, that apparently Stan Lane was getting some sort of like hair transplant or something like that. And they did the whole bit where they had him wear the boxing headpiece. And they said that he had to wear it because if the fans booed, it would hurt his ears, and it was a reason to make the fans boo, and it was just absolutely hilarious. And of course, wearing the boxing headpiece was really all designed just to keep Stan's new hair surgery in place. but Stan Lane, and wow, who can forget those matches on TBS when he and Bobby Eaton would have those squash matches against Mike Jackson and guys like that. And every one of those squash matches were like works of art. because, you know, they would just come up and they'd do the flapjack, they'd do the double goozle. They had all these great nicknames that Cornette came up with for the, you know, the moves that the tag team moves the guys were doing. So Stan Lane, another guy that probably deserves to be in some sort of tag team wrestler Hall of Fame.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And so I referenced also that team he'd had with Brian St. John earlier. So this was, I've talked about this with our old friend Pete Lederberg. And when Stan Lane first came in, he was green. I believe he was trained by Ric Flair, if I'm correct. That was always what the story was. But when he came in, he had a great look to him, but he really wasn't a great performer. And over the period that he was in Florida, which is something like 5 or 6 months, he tremendously grew as a worker. Like, you could see the difference. And he formed this team with Brian St. John. And Brian St. John, what a talent. What a story. Makes no sense. Brian St. John basically got burned out of the business at a very, very young age, only worked 3 or 4 territories, retired, went to New Mexico, became an EMT or a paramedic, and wanted nothing to do with professional wrestling, got married, had several children, and that's it. Just completely just walked away. But what a talent Brian St. John was. And they formed a team. So here was a team that came in. And St. John, also a young guy, and he was a homesteader. He was a guy that, if I recall correctly, I think it was the Buttons South in Fort Lauderdale, Jeff, kind of where you are. He was a bouncer. He was the doorman there. So he formed this team with Stan Lane, and they were young. They were kids. And all of a sudden, they got this massive push. They're beating the top teams in the state like Jack Briscoe and Jim Garvin, and they held the Florida tag team titles. And I thought we were looking at the future here. Stan Lane obviously had a great career when you're talking about great tag team wrestlers, and Brian St. John just faded off to the New Mexico desert, which is really bizarre.
First of all, since you mentioned the Button South, I will neither confirm or deny that I may have closed the Button South with my friends a few times. It was a great drinking and partying venue back when I was younger. So as I'm going down my list here, I noticed that I had a run of about 4 great heel tag teams. So let's take a look at 5 legendary great heel tag teams. Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch, Adrian Adonis and Jesse Ventura, Bill Dundee and Buddy Landell, Ted DiBiase and Steve Dr. Death Williams, and Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson. Go.
Where do you even go with that? So should we start referencing our top 10 list, because you're naming teams that have a clear spot in my
let's make them wait.
Let's make them okay. We will absolutely make them wait and savor the moment when we release what our choices are. Steve Williams and Ted DiBiase. So here's what I think's really interesting. Two guys that were completely different wrestlers, completely different styles, and somehow they were able to blend together and probably become one of the greatest tag teams of all times in the 1980s, at least. So they were fantastic. And DiBiase's another guy, you know, and so is Williams. Williams and Gordy. I mean, we talked about Miracle Violence Connection, and that's just a great team. But, you know, Ted DiBiase was also a part of some other great teams, prior to that. So, yeah, just fantastic. What were the other teams you mentioned?
Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch, the Outlaws.
Oh, Jesus. I mean, yeah, so the Outlaws. So they didn't make my top 10 list. And I'm going to tell you why. And they probably deserve to. So a lot of what's on my list are teams that either I saw or I saw enough of that I knew. And unfortunately, with Dusty and Dick, I didn't really get to see enough, because their run as a team kind of ended by the early 80s. There was always this period where they would reunite and get together or feud with each other. But at the same time, I never really saw them as a team as much as I did opponents of each other. But that being said, everybody who saw them together said, this is one of the great tag teams. And what you had spoken about earlier, you and I both did. We reached out to other wrestling aficionados or historians. We reached out to people in the business. And, you know, the Outlaws come up a lot. You will see that that they come up on a lot of different lists for a lot of people.
Yeah, I remember classically the story that my friends Greg Good and Dave By God, I'm going to buy a ticket to come to the Fan Fest Flaherty. Little prodding there, Barry. Told about the night that the Outlaws debuted at the Miami Beach Convention Center. They're sitting there as young fans, probably early teens. And Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes come walking through the front door of the convention center, maybe like between the matches or right before the matches started, carrying their suitcase, making generally a spectacle of themselves, saying, "Where the hell is the dressing room?" And making people scatter to get out of the way. And they just immediately became over as heels, according to Dave and Greg. So, yeah, one of the all-time great tag teams. No question about it. Real quick, Adrian Adonis and Jesse Ventura.
So I was, I don't forget who I was talking, and I think I was talking with my son about this, and it was, and you mentioned this last week. It's a good team. It's a good team. It's not, Jesse was never a good worker. He found a spot in the team. They were very entertaining together. Adrian did all the work. Jesse was more the mouthpiece, but I never got Jesse in the ring and in ring action. So, good team. Obviously, they held the titles in the AWA for like 2 years or something. I mean, they were champions.
I think, I don't mean to interrupt, part of the appeal, I really think, was you had Adrian, who was a tremendous worker and totally carried the team as far as the work rate. Jesse, because we're talking about Vern's AWA here, and, you know, probably, let's be honest, probably the most conservative promotion in the country, okay? Yeah. And you had Jesse Ventura coming out there with the shirts that said Plato's Retreat, and he would literally, on every show, try to do something to shock either Gene Okerlund or one of the AWA announcers. And that was part of the appeal. You know, I think maybe as I'm reconsidering it, as good as Adrian Adonis was, as far as this team goes, this team might fit into the, you know, great act, because they really were a tremendous act. But, you know, you're absolutely right. Jesse Ventura, and I got to be honest with you, I think Jesse would even agree to this, was never a great worker. He was, you know, a great interview. There's no question about that. And he was the mouthpiece of the team. Even though Adrian could certainly talk, he was the mouthpiece of the team, and he made them a spectacle, almost like a northern version of the Freebirds, if you will. I can go as far as to say that. So, Bill Dundee and Buddy Landell, we've referenced them numerous times on this podcast.
Yeah, we have referenced them, and you brought up to the Bill and Buddy Show, 1986 Memphis. It was everything that promotion, the foundation of that promotion was built on them at that stage. There was really not much else to see in Memphis at that point, but what they had going was a main event act that could have played anywhere in the United States. And Bill Dundee with Jerry Lawler, I got a message this week, and it was somebody where I guess they didn't take issue with what I said last week. I think they wanted more of a clarification because it was friendly. But it was, you know, what did you mean when you said that if Bill, you know, was a little taller, he could have been a bigger star nationally? He was a great star. And Bill was. But what I meant by that, which kind of what I said, if Bill was 4 or 5 inches taller, I think Bill Dundee would have been in the WWE or the NWA, and he would have been a serious wrestler, as opposed to when he came into the NWA and was like managing Sir William Regal and wearing the bowler hat and a monocle or some shit like that. Bill Dundee had every qualification to be a major league star, except for the height factor with that. But you put Dundee with Landell or Dundee with Lawler, and it's gold. It's absolute gold.
Yeah, Dundee was absolutely such a heat magnet. And, you know, you referenced his time with William Regal. His time when Buddy and he came into the NWA, I want to say late summer of 86, when they came in before Buddy had his infamous fall from grace there. And, you know, I probably have said this before, but one of the greatest interviews I ever saw was they were cutting a promo, the two of them, and Bill Dundee makes a comment to David Crockett about how he's the only man in wrestling with Joan Collins' private phone home phone number. And it just absolutely cracked me up. And, you know, it's a great line. The sad thing about it is when Buddy fell from grace, he took Bill down with him, which is really sad because Bill, you know, and the other thing that was hilarious on the worldwide shows is Bill, who was not in any program with Dusty Rhodes, used to go on and cut promos on Dusty Rhodes, who would like then proceed to ignore him completely. But Bill was such a great heel. And, you know, you see him as the friend of Lawler and the babyface, and he has this kind of, you know, the charm. But really, seriously, it's Bill as the heel that is the absolute gold standard right there. And so, speaking of a man I compared Bill with, Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson. And certainly, as far as working, one of the all-time great teams, there's no question about that.
Oh, good God, yeah. So, you know, it's a shame what happened in the WWF, too, because even though I was such a Horseman fan, and their matches in the NWA, and really the Horsemen at that stage were the reason. The Horsemen, I guess, in the Rock and Roll Express were kind of the reason a lot of us were watching the NWA. When they went to the WWF, the potential was there. Things didn't work out, and they were gone quickly. And really, Tully and Arn, they were, do you remember just before they left to go to the WWF, they were entering into a feud with the Midnight Express.
Oh, boy,
right? And it just never took off. And that would have been, for all of us hardcore fans, that was like the fucking dream right there. That was like the apex of what we wanted in professional wrestling. Tully and Arn, mind-blowingly good. It just, you know, it sucks what happened, and it sucks, you know, with Tully and you know, and whether he, you know, did cocaine and you know, allegedly did cocaine and had the test and couldn't get rehired in WCW or whatever the story was, and I forget what the story was, but that basically ended his career. You know, I know he did some shots in ECW after that and some other promotions, but just what a shame, because Tully and Arn, in my opinion, should be the team, based off of what we saw, that we were talking about with a team that had a 15 or 20 year run. Absolutely.
Yeah. And both of them could talk. Both of them could really create heat at ringside. They were good. So, you know what, I'm going to take a little pause here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through, as we both mentioned, we reached out to some people that are in the business. We reached out to people that are fans of the business. And, you know, what I did was I said, give me real quick off the top of your head, give me three or four teams that you always felt were kind of underrated. And, you know, I had a lot of people respond. Our good friend Pete Lederberg responded with approximately 7 pages. So I'll try to edit Pete's response, but I'll throw out and I will mention that when I mention these people's names, I may not mention every team that they wrote me about, because some of the teams we've referenced. But let's go first to our friend Howard Baum. Howard mentions the Bruise Brothers. I'm going to assume that he's talking about Troy Graham and Porkchop Cash in Memphis, who were a great act. He mentioned the aforementioned Stan Lane and Brian St. John, Bob Orton Sr. and Jr., who we both mentioned, Coco and Bobby Eaton. Here's one that we haven't talked about, Butch Reed and Sweet Brown Sugar. 1982 Florida, this was the number one babyface tag team, no question about it.
Yeah, so it was. So Dusty really wasn't around that much. He was traveling. He was working for Crockett a lot, and he would show up occasionally. But the truth was, this was the team that was working on top. And arguably, Hacksaw Butch Reed was the number one babyface in the state. So they were a great tag team. Again, Sweet Brown Sugar had probably the best dropkick in professional wrestling. If he didn't have the best, he was certainly right there. They were a great team. We do joke, Pete and myself, that every single time they went up for the jumping high five, they would miss. But that being said, everything else they did was kind of spot on, and they were money. They were a great team, and you know, we've talked about this previously too. Sweet Brown Sugar taking off the mask killed his career. Had that mask stayed on, these two should have stayed together. They could have gone territory to territory. They were great, absolutely. Yeah.
And the last team that Howard mentioned, and, you know, here amazingly is one of the all-time great heel tag teams that people have forgotten about, and that is Ric Flair and Greg Valentine. How great were those guys as a tag team?
Yeah, they were. It's, you know, so I've said before, I'm not the biggest Greg Valentine fan for some reason. I think I'm the only, let me clearly say, I think I'm the only one in the world that isn't. So clearly it is me. It's not everybody else. But that being said, yeah, of course, that was a great team. And I think they had some matches against the Anderson brothers that were supposedly legendary in the Carolinas.
Sure. Our friend Eric Chulminski, who joined us on one of our episodes before his trip to Japan, mentioned Bobby Fulton and Tommy Rogers, the Fantastics. Great tag team that really were kind of under the radar until they came to Crockett and had their program with the Midnight Express and really just took them up to another level.
Yeah, so you know what's funny about this too? You and I were kind of coming up with our own separate list, but we're obviously reaching out to the same people because I reached out to Eric and Pete as well, and Eric did not tell me that you reached out to him. But Eric, so Eric also, he pulled out the Fantastics, and to that end, I reached out to a bunch of people as well. The Fantastics were mentioned four or five times, and generally they were considered underrated. So the Fantastics were a great team. Again, so you and I have talked about this previously. I was not a fan of the ass wiggling. That was really something about that when you're in your mid 20s and you got guys wearing bow ties and they're wiggling their asses, it kills it. That being said, they're as workers, these two were, you know, these guys are A with a major plus sign next to it. They were great. Eric also brought up another team, and I'm sure he did it with you, which was the PYT Express, correct?
Yes.
Yes, so PYT Express, I like these guys. So what about Norvell Austin? We're talking great tag team wrestlers. There's another one.
Hall of Fame tag team wrestler, no question about it.
Absolutely. Norvell Austin with Sputnik Monroe, former Florida Tag Team Champion, with PYT Express, with Coco Ware, and then part of the Midnight Express. So here's
part of
Norvell.
If I may interrupt, the original version of the Midnight Express in the Southeast Territory.
Which was Randy Rose, Norvell Austin, and Dennis Condrey?
Correct. There's another Dennis Condrey reference.
There you go. There's another one. Randy Rose, right? Exactly. Yeah. So it is crazy when you see that these guys, and maybe that says something, Jeff. Maybe we're looking at this now when we're kind of dissecting tag team wrestling, and it's like, wait a minute, if you were great in one team, you can be great in any team. So guys like Bobby Eaton, Steve Kern, Dennis Condrey, Coco, there's a common denominator here of the greatest tag teams were guys that were part of several great tag teams.
And one
Maybe
of the
it truly says something.
Yeah, one of the teams, talk about a great tag team. And boy, I remember these guys and how great they were. And that is the team of Gino Hernandez and Chris Adams in World Class, the dynamic duo. Who can forget Gino Hernandez coming to the ring, looking dead into the camera and saying, "We are your world tag team champions." Oh, he was great when he did that.
So again, Chris Adams, Gino Hernandez, Tully Blanchard. Gino Hernandez, in my opinion, part of two great tag teams. I think I preferred his team with Adams better, though the team with Tully, my God, I still, you know, but that stuff with Adams, that was great. So for me, with the Von Erichs, and I would watch World Class every week, and I think it was usually on 11 o'clock where we were in Fort Lauderdale in Miami at that time. And if I wasn't home, I was recording it. But for me, the highlight was watching Adams and Hernandez. And I liked Adams as a baby face. I was a huge Chris Adams fan. Loved him as a baby face. But my God, when he got together with Gino Hernandez and they were heels, they were the best. And there's a match that maybe we look at some point down the road when they lose and they get their head shaved. To me, that's just a fantastic match. And these guys, this was it for me. You know, when Gino died, and then it seemed like it kind of derailed Chris's career. You know, and I don't know if that's coincidental or what had happened, but I was really bummed. And I think all the hardcore fans back in, that's either 85 or 86, when Gino passed away, I think we were all truly bummed when that happened, because Gino's a guy, you know, maybe we devote a whole show to Gino and the legacy of what could have been and what was, but just something else. And here was a guy that, hey, he was a good looking guy, the handsome half breed, but he was built, you know, he was built kind of, you know, he wasn't muscular. He was built kind of like your next door neighbor if he's in shape to some degree. But and as a wrestler, he was good. He was not, you know, at the upper elite. But he was, in my opinion, he was kind of the total package in a sense. He was a guy that was great on the mic. He looked great. He could wrestle, but he had this arrogance about him that you could not fabricate. Gino, when you saw him as a heel, you wanted to punch him right in the face because you believed it. And I think he really was an arrogant kind of guy in real life like that. So this was a great team. And honestly, you know, I think the only thing that harbors Chris Adams and Gino Hernandez is length of time together, because I think had they not had all this excess in their personal lives and they were able to keep their heads on straight, they could have been a team and obviously broken up and feuded with each other and then become a team again. But they could have had a career that they could have worked together for 10 or 15 years. They were gold together.
Yeah, Gino Hernandez, let's stop and remember, you know, you talk about, I think we've mentioned in the past that Terry Gordy was headlining the Omni, I think at like 19 or 20 years old as part of the Freebirds. But Gino Hernandez by himself was headlining the Sam Houston Coliseum in Houston. And I don't think he was more than 19 or 20 years old. I mean, he was a main event heel right out of the gate for Paul Bosch. And I know he had the big program with Jose Lothario, but that guy was on fire in the state of Texas for a long, long time. Yeah, there are a lot of people. That's one of the guys, you know, when the Horsemen began to go into different variations, shall we say, when Ole left, when Luger left. One of the guys talked about is, you know, a guy that would have been a good member of the Horsemen is Gino Hernandez, because Gino was the guy that would totally would have become part of that gimmick. And good Lord, I can't even imagine Ric
Wasn't
Flair
that
and
the
Gino.
Rumor though?
Yeah.
Wasn't that the rumor that
try to imagine
be a Horseman?
Try to imagine Ric Flair and Gino Hernandez in a bar together. The bar would never close, you know.
No, and, it would right, and they would just be lining up the women, like it would just be like a line. So you mentioned something else. So we're discussing – so I just mentioned the rumor of Gino becoming a Horseman, which I knew I had heard. But the other rumor, or is it not a rumor, of Paul Bosch and Gino Hernandez?
And that is one of the great wrestling rumors of all time as to the – shall we say the parental lineage of Gino Hernandez, and the fact that there are those out there that thought that Gino Hernandez looked remarkably similar to a young Paul Bosch, and I will leave it at that. And whether or not that explained why, whether it's true or not, I mean, Gino Hernandez drew money, whether he was Paul's kid or not.
Oh, absolutely. Too.
But
absolutely.
You know, so it wasn't like this was not George Gulas. Let's put it that way. Gino Hernandez was on top because he deserved to be on top. So, okay. Going to real quick jump for the last part of this thing, my friend, John Hitchcock, who's also been on the show, John Hitch, of course, goes back into the '60s. In the Mid-Atlantic area. So he threw a couple names out there. Ole and Gene Anderson, probably one of the greatest heel tag teams of all time. Work the arm. And they would turn the crowd completely nuts by just seemingly mortally wounding one member of the tag team they were going against. John also mentioned the Bolos. Now, John, I got to correct you here for one thing, buddy, because Jody Hamilton himself sat there in the very first Fan Fest in Tampa and told me there was no tag team called the Bolos. There was the Great Bolo and Bolo. He was very specific about the fact that there was no tag team called the Bolos, by God. So, but of course, they, of course, morphed eventually into the original Mask Assassins, who's a team that I may or may not be talking about at another point. Here's another team that John mentioned that we haven't brought up yet. The New Breed, Chris Champion and Sean Royal. Tell me what you remember about those guys.
I love those guys. So we were lucky enough to see them. So both of these guys started off as prelim undercard guys in Florida, and they were doing jobs left and right. And slowly, as the old way was in the old days, they started to rise on the cards, and they formed a tag team. They quickly went to Crockett, and I love the New Breed. It was a goofy gimmick, but you had two guys that they looked like they could wrestle. They were innovative, and that was the cool thing. It was almost like a junior version of the Midnight Express, that you actually had guys going out there trying to work as a team as opposed to putting two guys together. So, short-lived, whatever happened with the car accident, and then I guess came back and wrestled and had a re-injury because he came back too soon, and Sean Royal kind of retired at a young age, and Chris Champion went through some just terrible problems in his life, a lot of those self-created. and wasted potential. Because at the end of the day, I love the new breed. I thought that was so cool.
John Royal could cut a great promo. He did a great impression of Dusty Rhodes. I remember that. And maybe he might have got himself in a little bit of hot water with Dusty now that I mention it, because I don't know if Dusty was as big a fan as some of the rest of us were of John Royal's promos. But they were great. They were a great team. And Chris Champion used to do these crazy, crazy spots at the time. And he just he was all arms and legs. But he could do some great high spots. So let's take a look now at we did some heel teams. Let's take a look at some great babyface tag teams that we can mention as far as historical content. How about Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood and the Midnight Rockers? And let's also go. We'll go more newer. Edge and Christian. Tell me what you remember about these three teams.
Sure. So let's start off with the first team you mentioned. So we've discussed these guys previously. This is probably one of the best pure babyface teams of the 80s, at least the first half of the 80s. Steamboat and Youngblood. And truthfully, I guess breaking up was the best thing for Steamboat because certainly it put him at a different level, and he really was. But this was a great tag team. They were flawless, and, yeah, I can't say enough. Jay Youngblood, to me, is just a tragedy. His daughter is in the CWF Archives Facebook group, and every time there's something that with Jay Youngblood, who really had a very short run in Florida, I always tag his daughter. She is just a fantastic person. This was a great team. Edge and Christian. So Edge and Christian from the new era, and I guess that's really how we break this up, old era versus new era. They were a really, really solid team. They had, and their team was good. They had that finishing maneuver, the concerto, where they would give the guy the double chair shot. And that was kind of innovative. It was not something that I think I had seen previously. And the truth is, it was their interviews and their charisma. These guys were best friends in real life, and it showed up on camera, which I liked. I'm sorry, what was the middle team you brought up?
Sean and Marty, the Midnight Rockers.
Ah, Shawn Michaels.
I think you've talked Shawn about Shawn Michaels.
They were a very, very good tag team. So in the dying days of the AWA, you had Buddy Rose and Doug Summers, another great underrated tag team that nobody ever talks about, against the Midnight Rockers, and they were having four-star matches. They were having matches, you know, AWA was drawing nothing at that stage, and at the same time, these are probably some of the best matches in the United States. So the Midnight Rockers were a really, really good team.
Yeah, unfortunately, they were sort of hounded by the fact that they behaved kind of like assholes, and I think it really hurt them as a tag team. Of course, when Sean became a single, the fact that he was an asshole seemed to have helped his career because he went to heights that he could not reach as part of the tag team. As long as we're on the subject of the Edge and Christian, you know, one of the things I noticed was as I was making this list, there was a time period, I want to say, let's say 15 years ago, just throw out a random figure, where tag team wrestling had really sort of gone through a dry phase because, you know, for the most part, you had Edge, Christian, the Hardy Boys. You had a couple other teams that were well-known that I'll be discussing later. But tag team wrestling kind of went through a dry spell, let's be honest. And there weren't a lot of great tag teams for a while. And so teams like the Hardy Boys and Edge and Christian really stood out because there wasn't a lot more out there. You know, some of the other times we talked about the 70s and the 80s and Memphis and Florida and the Mid-Atlantic area when it was just dominated by great tag teams. So the fact that you had these two teams that were both really good, they kind of stood out because there was no other alternative really.
No, you're 100% right. So, Jeff, I'm actually going to take the ball for a moment, and then I'm going to throw the ball back into your court, and I want to get your opinion. So I reached out to my friend Masa Ori, and Masa, if you know who he is, and I know you know who he is, Masa's considered the number one wrestling fan in the entire world. He is a Japanese super fan. Anytime any wrestler, any gaijin ever goes over there, Masa will, he meets them, he gets photos, he's well respected, he is friends with every wrestler for the last 30 years, and everybody thinks the world of the guy, and he's the nicest guy. He is also a literal computer when it comes to Japanese wrestling. You can ask Masa a question, and you will get a 4-page response with detail like you could not believe. It's unreal. So I asked him for a list, and he threw out a bunch of teams at me, and I want to get your feeling on some of these. So in no particular order, the Can-Am Express, Phil LaFon and Doug Furness, Chigusa and Lioness Asuka, and Stan Hansen and Bruiser Brody. So those are three teams I know you're familiar with all, and I know that you're a huge Chigusa fan. So what are your thoughts on those teams?
I would say two of those teams are probably amongst the greatest tag teams of all time. The Can-Am team with Furness and Crawford, they were a really good team. They were really not ever pushed to the main events in All Japan. They were I hate to say middle of the card guys, because it was more like that semi-main event, as a better way of putting it. And they always had good matches. Doug Furness had incredible leg strength and power moves. Crawford was a great worker who I believe came out of Calgary. They were a great team. The first Chigusa and Lioness were an amazing team. Yeah, I got to be honest with you. When I was preparing my list, I really didn't prepare a list of great women's team. I was kind of exclusively keeping this to men. But if I was doing a top 10 and including women, Chigusa and Lioness would probably be somewhere in my top three, because they were absolutely amazing, as were teams like Manami Toyota and Toshio Yamada. There was Akira Hokuda and, oh, God, I can't think of her tag. But we can go Condor Saito and Bull Nakano. I believe I may have referenced Bull Nakano once or twice on this show. They were a great tag team without even Dump. Dump was the leader, but it was Condor and Bull that were the amazing team out of that group. And Brody and Hansen, no question about it. And the Crush Girls, no question about it, too.
Yeah, definitely, too. So another name that I reached out to is the legendary former NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, Dory Funk Jr.
Who's that guy? Who does he think he is?
Have you ever heard of this guy before? So anyways, Dory Funk Jr., who will be at the Fan Fest taking place in Lutz, Florida on June the 2nd. You can look at our Facebook page, which is the Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry Facebook page. Also, CWF Archives Facebook page. You can get full details on this Fan Fest coming up. But I reached out to Dory, and I kind of had a feeling what Dory was going to say, and he was right on the money. He said the Briscoe Brothers, the Funk Brothers, Jumbo Sharuda, there's your Jumbo Sharuda reference, and Giant Baba.
Oh, I was going to go Patrick Swayze.
Could you imagine? Like kind of like a dream. But then I said, who would you consider, Dory, as far as underrated tag team? So he gave me a team. It's a team before my time, before your time. It's his father, Dory Funk Sr. and Iron Mike DiBiase. And he said this was a great tag team in West Texas. They wound up wrestling each other for several years as well. And I believe this is the territory where Mike DiBiase also suffered the fatal heart attack in the late 60s that actually killed him. So it was just kind of cool. It's, you know, it's always interesting, you know, when you reach out to a worker to see what they're going to say. Are they going to talk about themselves, or are they going to talk about a completely different team? Another person that I reached out to, Superstar Billy Graham, former WWF champion. So he gave me
two selections. You are name-dropping today, Rose.
I am name-dropping. So Superstar's first choice was Superstar Graham and Ivan Koloff. He said, we teamed in the WWF. We teamed also in the AWA. The truth was, we weren't a team that was together long enough, but he said, this was a great tag team. I said, but give me a team, Superstar. And I said, Superstar, give me a team, brother. And give me a team that you weren't a part of that you think is the greatest team of all time. And he said, unquestionably, without a doubt, my brother, it was Pat Patterson and Ray Stevens. And he said, what this team did in the San Francisco area when he was kind of breaking in was legendary. He said, I saw a little bit. I heard a lot of it. But, you know, he said he would be in the dressing rooms. He would be out in Northern California, and people would still be talking about the team of Patterson and Stevens years later. So those were his selections.
Well, so you've offered Dory Funk Jr. and superstar Billy Graham. So I'm now going to go to the celebrity portion of my part of this podcast. You got the world champion, two world champions there. So I'm going to start off with the great Tom Nash, because anyone will tell you that the great Tom Nash is equal to Dory Funk Jr. and superstar Billy Graham.
Absolutely.
Tom Nash, for the uninitiated, the original Blackheart, ladies and gentlemen.
It was a really good team.
Exactly. It was a great gimmick.
Yeah,
you know?
Really. You know, for whatever reason, their career wasn't probably as long as it should have been. They worked in Japan. They were in Calgary, obviously, South Florida Independence. And they got a WCW run in. But, you know, as a team, and regardless who was underneath the hood, that the Blackhearts were a pretty solid tag team.
Yeah, they also had a nice run in All Japan, where Tom continues to tell stories about how he was potatoed numerous times by Stan Hansen. But
not a fan of Stan Hansen, right?
No, as I recall, yeah. He's not. He talked about his favorite tag team of all time is the aforementioned Sato and Saito. He spoke glowingly about that tag team. But a team that he mentioned that we have not brought up yet is the team of Paul Orndorff and Jimmy Snuka, who are the world tag team champions in Mid-Atlantic, I want to say 79. And there is some footage out there of their team. And yeah, they're an amazing, amazing team, considering the fact that Paul Orndorff was really relatively new to the business at the time, Barry.
Yeah, he was too. And this is one of Lederberg's choices too. So yeah, they really were a great tag team. This was, you know, you go back to the Mid-Atlantic area, and you look, and you know, when these guys were also teaming together, and there was such this wealth and this depth of talent. It's like, you know, how could you have a region, and you're covering, it's a territory, but you're still covering three or four states. You've got both Carolinas, you've got Virginia. I don't know where else they went, but you had guys, you had Flair, you had Valentine, you had the Andersons, you had Snuka, you had Orndorff, and you had 20 other guys that were all main event talents. pardon me. I think it's one of the great areas in professional wrestling, but that's a really underrated tag team. Again, I think the only thing that actually hurts that is the longevity piece. They weren't together too long.
Sure. So, and the continuing celebrity portion of our analysis here, Kevin Sullivan. I reached out to Sully. I said, tell me some great teams that you consider to be underrated. He said, Bob Orton and Dick Slater. He said, Ron and Don Wright, get the chisel. And he also mentioned Ivan Koloff and Alexis Smirnoff, pointing out a story where the United States had boycotted the Olympics in 1980, and there was a moment on television where the local sportscaster in Atlanta, there was a match where Ivan Koloff and Alexis Smirnoff had lost a match in the Omni, and the sportscaster in Atlanta got on the air and said, well, the United States is not in the Olympics, but tonight the United States won, by God.
Yeah, so Ron and Don Wright, that's definitely, pardon me, a legendary tag team in the state of Tennessee. Again, they didn't get any sort of national exposure. I don't know if they went out of, you know, Tennessee or Alabama, anywhere in the South. So it's hard for me to say. Orton Jr. and Slater, absolutely. And Orton Jr. and Slater, I mean, here you got two of the best workers, I think, to ever work in a ring. And have you ever heard the story of Orton Jr. and Slater and the fight that occurred in the dressing room?
Is that the one where he tossed him out of the dressing room after he knocked him out?
Yeah. So here's the funny part. Kevin Sullivan's the one who told me this story. So apparently it took place in Orlando, and Kevin Sullivan was there that night when it took place. So they were working against each other. And Slater, I guess they broke in right around the same time, but Dick was a natural right from the get-go. And Bob took a little more time to get his bearings in professional wrestling, but Dick was almost a main event guy within his first year. So they had a match, and Orton Jr. said something to Slater after the match, and he said, you know, Dick, I don't feel like you were selling enough for me out there. I needed to get my spots in. You needed to be selling a little bit more for me. And Slater, I guess, took offense to it and just knocked him out, threw him out of the dressing room. Bob Orton Sr. is there, and he's sitting on the bench, and Slater looks over to Orton Sr., and he said, unless you want some of that, your ass better stay on that bench. So just thought that was a kind of an unusual story. But these two had a relationship where they wrestled each other. I've said many times, of the five best matches I have ever seen live in my life, Bob Orton Jr. versus Dick Slater, 1976 in Miami Beach, was one of the best matches I ever saw live. So they wrestled each other. They teamed together. You couldn't go wrong. I would say Kevin's probably on the money with that one. Alexa Smirnoff and Ivan Koloff, I don't know. I saw some of their stuff. I would say Koloff Saito, Koloff Patterson, maybe better. But again, personal opinion on that one.
No, and I think part of the reason why Koloff and Smirnoff were so over was because the incredible heat that they had because of the boycotting of the Olympics. And Koloff and Smirnoff were pushed absolutely perfectly at that point in Georgia. So another person I reached out to, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee stud. Hey, that guy should get a podcast, you know. And I asked Ron for some choices for an underrated tag teams. He mentioned Don and Al Green, who, if I'm not mistaken, were the original Heavenly Bodies bearer.
Yes, sir.
He mentioned Jackie and Don Fargo. And he mentioned the original Assassins, who we've also talked about. So I certainly want to thank the Tennessee Stud for reaching out to us and offering up his choices. I have heard Don and Al Green. I've heard some great stories about how fantastic a tag team they were back in the day. So, Barry, let me continue with our list. Here's a team that I want to talk about. My friend Jeff Steele, who was one of the guys that really smartened me up to the business. So shout out to brother Jeff for that. I asked him for an underrated team, and that's the next team I'm going to talk about, a team that was absolutely fantastic, that were never pushed as main eventers, but holy crap, were they entertaining. Hollywood, John Tatum, and Jack Victory. Do you remember that team, Bear?
I love that team. So absolutely, too. So that was a team. And Jack Victory, I love Jack Victory. I just, there's something about the guy. I liked his punches, first off. But I really liked that team. You had Missy Hyatt. Missy Hyatt had a brick in her purse. And John Tatum.
Excuse me, Barry, in her Gucci bag, please.
In her Gucci bag, that's right. And so here I'm gonna go completely off topic. And I meant to bring this up when we were doing the nude scene episode, and for some reason, if I don't write it down, I generally forget. My opinion, Missy Hyatt, 1986, maybe going into 87, baby blue powder dress in the UWF, hottest woman ever in professional wrestling. I'm not talking about as a wrestler either, because she certainly wasn't. My opinion, and I'm not talking about Missy now. I'm talking about 1986 Missy, my hottest female ever in professional wrestling. Jeff, who is yours?
As I'm sitting here thinking about it, Miss Elizabeth was really strong when she was just debuting in the WWF in the mid-80s. Let me see who else comes right to the top of my head. That's like the first, you know, she was a... Let me see. Yep, I would have to go.
Were you a Sunshine fan? You can admit it. Were you a Sunshine fan?
No, not so much. She didn't really. Oh, wait a minute. Nancy Sullivan, the Fallen Angel. Yeah, she was.
That's a good choice.
Yeah, she was top notch. Absolutely. So, okay, are we done getting off topic here, Barry? Can we get back to the subject matter at hand?
Let's get back. Absolutely.
Not your teenage dreams, mister. So let's talk about. Go back to a couple of heel teams. Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle. The Blackjacks, and we'll go Dory Funk Jr. and David Von Erich.
Wow, Dory Funk Jr., David Von Erich, as good as it's going to get. They were great. You know, so here's the interesting part, too, when we talk about that. So the rumors forever, much like Magnum TA, was that David Von Erich was going to get the NWA World's Heavyweight title, and he was being groomed by Dory, and he was sent to Florida to work heel because he was going to wind up getting the title. And for years, my response when somebody would say that was, where's the proof? This sounds like an assumption. Well, at the last CWF Legends Fan Fest, this question was asked, and I believe you asked this question, Jeff, and Kevin Sullivan's response was, David Von Erich was going to get the NWA World's Heavyweight title. They were a great team. 1982 was, I think it's your favorite year, because you and I have talked about this. I think it was your favorite year for CWF. But really, there was what David Von Erich did with Dory Funk Jr. was one of these things that was, it was magic. It doesn't occur. You can't force it. It happens, and this is exactly what it was. Again, 82 was a great year, but putting these two together was genius. Splitting them up, and then Von Erich's interviews afterwards, and calling Dory Squiggy from the Laverne and Shirley show. He would call him Squiggy. I just thought it was just great. And if you can find any of this stuff on YouTube, search it out, because it really is amazing stuff to see. I'm sorry, what were the other two teams?
Blackjacks. David, before you get to the Blackjacks, David Von Erich also, I do believe in the history of professional wrestling, the only wrestler to appear on camera during an interview with a roach clip in his hair.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah. I love that guy so much. Okay, the Blackjacks, Mulligan and Lanza.
Yeah, good. I think that's a good team right there. I think you had a really unique look. You had Blackjack Mulligan, who by those standards was a giant of a man. We just remembered him. The 2 year anniversary of his passing just occurred. Definitely no celebration going on there, but he was a giant of a man back in his day. They had a great look. They had a manager. They were a good team. The stuff that I've seen, I don't know if they're in the upper echelon of tag teams. You know, they weren't doing a lot of tag team maneuvers, say like the Midnight Express or something. But I think part of it was when you looked at these guys, they looked like a couple of badasses. You know, especially Mulligan, they really did. I liked the glove. I liked the claw. A very, very good team. I just don't know if it's world-class tag team right there.
I mean, they were was a great big man team. So they were a team.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
How long did Dick the Bruiser make money off those guys? You know, because the whole, you know, irresistible force of Dick the Bruiser going up against the Blackjacks in Chicago and Indianapolis and all parts in between made money for a couple of years. I also mentioned Slaughter and Kernodle.
Yeah, you know what? A very, very good team. And again, I think this is one of those kind of like a magic moment, because Kernodle had primarily been, a lower card guy, and then he gets with Slaughter. And then, you know, you had Kernodle and Koloff as well, which is kind of an underrated tag team. It didn't make my list of underrated tag teams, but at the same time, Slaughter and Kernodle against Steamboat and Youngblood, that was main event stuff that was carrying that territory for a year or so.
Yeah. So let me just to finish off the and name drop here, some of the people that I also reached out to about their choices. Alex Marvez, a well-known sports figure on Sirius Satellite Radio covering the NFL. But in his initial days as a sports writer, wrestling fan and wrestling columnist, Alex Marvez, among the teams he mentioned were Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas, the Fantastics, and again, the New Breed. So we thank Alex. What do you remember about Haas and Benjamin? Barry, I got to be honest with you. That was during the period where I really wasn't watching wrestling. Do you remember much about them?
Yeah, they were extremely good. They were in the WWE, and then they went to ROH. They were an excellent tag team. And so, you know, it's the new generation, but yeah, really, really solid guys.
Yeah, I could just hear like our friend Chulminski now, because I'm going to get to Japan eventually, and he's going to go, "Hey, you forgot about these 24 teams." Chulminski's going to have a heart attack. Pete Lederberg, the aforementioned professor, Pete Lederberg, Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden, the Gibson brothers, and here is a team, Barry, that I had forgotten about. Here we go again. Hall of Fame tag team wrestler Ricky Morton and Ken Lucas, when they were in Southwest, were a terrific team. Next, Gary Baum. Who the hell's Gary Baum, you're asking yourself? No, he's not related to Howard. Gary Baum's a guy I work with that's a wrestling fan. And I asked him, and he said two things. He said, number one, my team would be Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo. Very good tag team. I think you'll agree, Barry.
Absolutely.
And then he wanted me to ask a question. And he said, Barry, I really wish you would spend more time talking about Selma Hayek, because... Boy, Gary went off on a riff about Selma Hayek that was just hilarious. I got to be honest with you.
I like this guy then. All right.
Yeah, exactly. He's a man to be admired.
Sure.
Okay. A couple other teams. The Steiner brothers, Rick and Scott. Now, here's what I'll tell you before you offer me your opinion. Rick and Scott Steiner, when they first became a tag team, 89, 90, 91, were tremendous and were really the quintessential babyface tough guy tag team at the time. They had Scott doing the Frankensteiner, Rick with those Steiner lines. It was a great team. I loved the stuff they did with Rick and when Nancy Sullivan became Robin Green. That stuff was just absolutely priceless. And along the same lines as them, a tag team that I'm going to tell you is on my most underrated list that people forgot about, Varsity. How great was the Varsity Club?
The Varsity Club. That's a great Kevin Sullivan impersonation. They were really good. So you had two guys who were Varsity, which was Steve Dr. Death Williams and Mike Rotunda. He always called him Rotunda. And then you had the devil Taskmaster, which was kind of leading the charge. They were great. They were absolutely great. And actually, all the teams you just mentioned were great.
Yeah, you had the Taskmaster who suddenly became a coach and was leading them in up and downs. That was pretty hilarious. Okay, so in the interest of offering some today team, let's talk about the team that to a lot of people are very polarizing. Some people feel over the last 5 years they've been the best tag team in the world. Other people think they're spot monkeys. Tell me what your opinion are of the Young Bucks.
So I like the Young Bucks too. It's I get the criticisms of the Young Bucks, but let me say this too. So I've been in arenas or bingo halls, and I've seen the Young Bucks wrestle live. So I probably have seen them 24 times, and every time they have a fantastic match. Are they spot monkeys? I don't know what that fucking term is, to be honest with you. And I do know what the term is. I understand what the connotation means for that. At the same time, the Young Bucks have had some of the best matches I probably have ever seen in my life live. And that really says a lot. I've been going to wrestling now for 47 years this year. So, I mean, I've been in arenas. I've been all over this country in different cities. They have amazing matches. Granted, they overdo it with the super kick. At this point, you could probably calm down with the super kick. That being said, these guys never phone it in. Every time they get out there and every time that I've seen the Young Bucks, they have great matches, and because they're putting forth maximum effort. I can also tell you, too, they're two of the nicest guys and most respectful guys of their fans of any wrestlers I have ever met. And that goes a long way. They did, and this goes back about 2 or 3 years ago, they did, in the space of 2 days, they wrestled in three shows, and they did two fan fests that took place over like three states. They didn't sleep. They did a show at the House of Hardcore, and I think it was for ROH or House of Hardcore. I think it was House of Hardcore, which was the Tommy Dreamer promotion. And they drove in from New York. They wrestled their match, and then at the end of the match, they went out and they sold their merchandise. And if you know the Young Bucks, they're very smart. They never miss a meet and greet opportunity or a chance to sell their merchandise. It's where they're making all their money. It's now midnight, and they're taking photos with fans for free. They're not even charging. I mean, I called a wrestler, and I'm not going to mention a name, but I called a wrestler to appear on our podcast, and his first question was, and I swear to God, I said, well, we'd like to discuss this, and he goes, how much? And I said, well, we're not paying. We don't pay for the podcast. This is a chance that you can plug something. These guys wrestled. They were selling their merchandise. They didn't have to take any photos. It's midnight. These guys are exhausted. They're still taking photos. So really, I have the ultimate respect. Again, I think these guys as workers are solid. I'm a fan.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I have watched matches of theirs that I've really enjoyed, and I've had watched matches that I thought were a little showy. But the recent match that they had with the team of Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi, the named Golden Lovers. That's got to be some kind of Japanese translation, lost in translation thing, because I happened to mention that to my wife. Honey, this tag team is called the Golden Lovers. And she kind of looked over from her phone and said, excuse me. And I told her, I said, honey, do you think 50 years from now, when our children's children are looking back at the legacy of the two of us, will they refer to us as the Golden Lovers? She said, perhaps.
They did.
Perhaps not.
Yeah, I first heard the name The Golden Lovers, and I think so. Kenny Omega is great, but I was a fan of Kota Ibushi before anybody else knew who he was. When I was watching some of his Japanese stuff, and I remember reaching out to Eric Chulminski, who's always my Japanese contact, and I'm like, who's this guy Ibushi, and how the fuck is he throwing this dropkick? Like, I couldn't believe it. So I was a big fan. That being said, the name Golden Lovers is arguably the worst name ever, and they released a video or something, an article where they were discussing how they came up with the name, but something is just a little off about that whole thing to me, but they are a very good tag team. But good God, we could go on about that name forever. So hey, I want to interject here for a minute too. So I reached out to a couple of guys, and one who is spending actually a lot of time on our Facebook page. For the uninitiated, if you don't know, Jeff and I made the decision to switch to a group page in about a couple of weeks ago, and really it's been for the good because it's taken off. But there's a guy that worked for years that's actually become a part of the page, which is Manny Fernandez. And I reached out to Manny Fernandez, and I said, Manny, I said, give me five teams that you think are the five greatest in professional wrestling. So he did mention himself and Rick Rude. Now, we haven't mentioned this team. This was a really, really good team. Rick Rude was a solid wrestler. Manny Fernandez was a legit badass. And when you put these two together, they were, in my opinion, they were the Road Warriors, but they could wrestle. If you remember, they would get...
I don't want to interrupt. I do remember that they had, I believe, a 60-minute draw with the Rock and Roll Express on TBS at the TBS studios. So, yeah, no, absolutely. I agree. They were a very good tag team, and I completely forgot about them. So Shout out to Manny for reminding us of what a great team they were.
But they would, if you remember, they would come in the ring and they would just destroy their opponents right away. They were doing the Road Warriors gimmick. The difference was these guys had this legitimate badass vibe. And then when they got into matches, like you just said, a 60-minute match with the Rock and Roll Express, that says something. Another team he mentioned was the Rock and Roll Express. And just to say also, when I reached out to Jerry Gray also said the Rock and Roll Express. Another common denominator between Manny Fernandez and Jerry Gray, the Midnight Express, but the Midnight Express with Dennis Condrey. Neither one chose Stan Lane. That being said, I reached out to a whole slew of fans, and only one person said any combo of the Midnight Express. Every other one was the Midnight Express with Dennis Condrey. So I thought that was interesting. Jerry Gray also had a couple other, which I just thought were fantastic choices. He also brought up Slater and Orton Jr., as you did. The Anderson brothers with Gene and Ole. Nobody else has said that. No, and here's another one.
I don't mean to correct you. John Hitchcock did say the Anderson
brothers. He did. You're right. But here's a team also that Jerry Gray brought up that my friend Greg Masorjak, Count Grog, brought up. Buddy Rose and Easy Ed Wiskowski.
Good choice. Good choice.
Yeah, really. And here's another one that's a little baffling to me that Jerry Gray brought up, but I get it. The Sawyer brothers. Buzz and Brett Sawyer. And I got to admit, there was a period there around 82 or so where these guys were super over.
Yeah, I think they were headlining the Omni against the Road Warriors, as a matter of fact. That's how over the team was. So, all right, let me just real quick go through a couple of teams that we haven't mentioned yet that were fantastic. Los Vatos Loco, Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero. Oh. How great were those guys in like 93 and 94? Just a super team, even though Eddie Guerrero unquestionably had the single worst mullet perhaps in wrestling. I will say that, but he was absolutely fantastic. There is no denying that. A couple other teams I want to mention. Let's go to Japan. Riki Choshu and Yoshiaki Yatsu. Fantastic team, especially in their program with second mention for Jumbo Tsuruta and Genichiro Tenryu. Mitsuharu Misawa and Toshiaki Kawada, Misawa and Kenta Kobashi, Kawada and Akira Taue. Here's a couple of short-lived teams, Akira Maeda and Nobuhiko Takada, Yoshiaki Fujiwara and Kazu Yamazaki. We mentioned Fujinami and Kimura and Genichiro Tenryu and Toshiaki Kawada. So Now it's time, before we get to our top five underrated and our top 10 personal favorites, Barry, give me a couple that you think are overrated.
Oh, absolutely, too. So I actually have three on my list. So I did reach out to our good friend Scott Teal. Scott Teal is one of the premier, if not the premier, wrestling historian. And I asked him, I said, so give me some that are underrated. Give me the ones you think are great. And give me your overrated. And he came back with overrated in a heartbeat. And he said, Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher. He said, truthfully, they were relegated to the AWA. They didn't go national, but for some reason, people talk about them like they're, you know, and he goes, honestly, they're not. I'd have to agree with that one. My next one is the Road Warriors.
Tremendously over, though. Bruiser and Crusher were really over. I'll give them that.
Oh, I don't. So I think of any of the teams I'm going to mention, and I just said the Road Warriors as well. Look, all these teams are tremendously over. And again, it's generational. You know, if you grew up in the AWA watching Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher in 1965 or whatever year, you probably go, wow, this is the greatest team I ever saw. I think from Scott's standpoint was that they were strictly regional. From my standpoint, I saw the Bruiser and the Crusher through the magic of videotape, which would be in the 70s, which I believe were the, you know, their prime was 10 years earlier. You know, they were way over the hill at this point. So you had these two guys who were kind of barrel-chested, but, you know, they were just bigger. They were short, not short, but they were average height. But they had guts. They were big. But, you know, you had these other guys selling for him. It just didn't look realistic to me. The Road Warriors, look, I know the Road Warriors are revolutionary. I get that. As a team, they had a couple of moves that they did together. Look, they held titles everywhere they went. They sold out. They drew and they made money, which is the business of professional wrestling, and I get it. At the same time, I think as workers, I think they were overrated. And then the Dudley boys. Look, the Dudleys, you and I have rehashed the Dudleys. Are they the greatest tag team of all time, as Paul Heyman declared and proclaimed a month or so back? They're not. They were a good tag team. Are they overrated? Yeah, they're a bit overrated to me. They're a good tag team. Again, I'm old school. You probably can't always go by me. The new generation is different. But how about a cut, Jeff, before we get into any more, how about a couple of teams that we haven't mentioned, which it's, so I did reach out to Scott Teal and Harry Grover, another guy that's a historian. They both brought up the Fabulous Kangaroos, the original.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And here's the thing. They both said this is probably the greatest tag team because this is the team that made tag team famous in the U.S., which is correct. The Kangaroos in the 50s were the biggest tag team out there. They're responsible for this.
That's why they called it an Australian tag team match, if I recall.
There you go.
Yeah. And just throwing some shout out, some love to Australia, besides the Kangaroos, the Royal Kangaroos that wrestled in Mid-Atlantic, I believe were, was it Boyd and Norman Frederick Charles were a great heel team, as well as we discussed the Sheepherders. Yeah. The Sheepherders were a great tag team also. And I'm talking Sheepherders from the 70s into the mid-80s, not the guys that would swing in the arms in the WWE, just to clarify there. Now, as far as what you were saying, a couple of thoughts. Bruiser and Crusher, it brings to mind a story. When I first started subscribing to The Observer, June of 1986-ish, I'll never forget there was a letter to the editor. Dave used to print two or three letters every issue. And I'll never forget reading a letter where the guy was talking about how he was not happy with the idea that his hero, the heroes of his youth, Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher, were selling.
Well, there you go.
Because apparently, you know, and it's probably true. Bruiser and Crusher never sold for anybody. The best part of any Dick the Bruiser and Crusher tag team match was watching Bobby Heenan completely chop his head off and fly, you know, all about the ring, taking bumps galore. So the best part of any of those matches were Bobby Heenan, no question about it. Regarding your overrated team, the Dudleys were one of the teams that I mentioned. Here again, I will say, I liked the Dudley gimmick originally when they were the kind of version of the brothers, the Hanson brothers from Slapshot, and Bubba had the glasses taped in the middle. And he says, "My name is Bubba." That was a good gimmick, and they suddenly morphed. It's kind of the way the Undertaker went from being a dead man to a biker. I don't know exactly how that happened, but the same thing happened with the Dudleys. All of a sudden, were these guys, and you know, there's a difference between getting heat at ringside by interacting with the crowd, and getting heat where you're watching it and you're just extremely troubled by what you're seeing. And I can remember going to the War Memorial Auditorium in Fort Lauderdale and seeing ECW shows where it was pretty apparent. I shouldn't say that. It appeared. How about that? That's a better way of putting it. That Bubba Ray and Devon were trying to goad fans into coming across the barrier and fighting them. And to me, that's not even cheap heat. That's wrong heat, you know, goad them. It's like the guy recently that got so much publicity for spitting a piece of gum at a kid, for God's sakes. I mean, that's not the right kind of heat. He got his ass kicked by the kid's father, which I thought was pretty hilarious. The other team I mentioned that I want to mention in the most overrated category, Public Enemy. Public Enemy was huge in ECW. They'd come out to, I believe the song was The Hot Stepper, and the crowd just put them over so huge. And they went to, I believe it was WCW when they went to first. And it was like the emperor has no clothes. All of a sudden, everyone realized that they were a one-trick pony. Now, mind you, in ECW, that one trick played really, really well. But when they showed up against better teams in WCW at the time, they kind of got exposed. So I feel like they were a little bit overrated. Let's see. Now, Barry, why don't we take a couple minutes here as we're getting ready to start wrapping up, because we're gonna end up having the longest show in the history of this podcast. Let's start off with give me five underrated tag teams. And I've made a conscious effort of not mentioning some of my teams. So you may end up talking about teams that we've already discussed here, but give me five underrated tag teams from your point of view.
Yeah. And you're 100% right too, because you brought up a lot of my top 10, which we'll get to shortly, but so underrated. My number five was the Masked Superstars, Jerry Lawler, Don Green, that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch. Holy shit. These guys were gold. It's a shame that both are gone, but Adonis and Murdoch were gold. Gino Hernandez and Chris Adams, or Gino Hernandez and Tully Blanchard. It's a tie. Underrated. My top two are guys that, and I do this all the time, and I'll post this in the CWF Archives Facebook group. Who would you have liked to have seen come into Florida that never did because they could have done well? The Love Brothers. You could have brought the Love Brothers into Florida, and they would have done so well. This was a great tag team. It was a fun gimmick. These guys could work. Money ready to be printed. They never, other than the IWA and kind of the Northeast, you know, and the Cleveland area and Buffalo. But these guys could have gone anywhere. My number one underrated tag team, and I don't know if they're even underrated, it's Gorman and Goliath. Gorman and Goliath is the other team. They wrestled one match in Florida. It took place in Miami Beach. I think they wrestled Raul Mata and Greg Valentine, which were two guys that they would have known from L.A. And for whatever reason, they did not come into the state of Florida. They were Georgia tag team champions. So they were right there. Eddie Graham was never a fan of Lucha Libre, but could you imagine Gorman and Goliath getting on the mic and talking to Cuban fans? It would have been, in my opinion, it would have been genius. I am a huge fan of all five teams or six teams that I just mentioned. All are underrated. All could have been, you know, whether it was, you know, a length of time together or the fact that they didn't travel enough, whatever it is, these teams are just money.
Okay, a couple things before I give you my list. A team that when you said the superstars reminded me, Mass Superstar and Super D, great team in Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Gorman and Goliath, the thing I remember most about Gorman and Goliath, and you want to talk about turning heat into blowtorch heat, is when they would introduce Gorman and Goliath at the Olympic Auditorium, and they would say, from Mexico, it was Jimmy Lennon, from Mexico, and then they would grab the mic and say something to Jimmy Lennon, and he'd say, I'm sorry, they are from New Mexico, and the Mexican crowd would just completely go apeshit and lose their minds because of that. I would like to mention also, the thought occurred to me when you started talking about Gorman and Goliath, we have not mentioned a lot of Mexican teams, and there are a lot of great, great Mexican teams. Other than Gorman Goliath and Guerrero and Barr, we really haven't mentioned any. I will say that I reached out to our friend of the show, Vandal Drummond, who did not respond. So that's on, and I did to Roy Lucier too. That's on you guys for no Mexican teams being on this show.
Thanks, Roy.
Yeah,
thanks,
right. Vandal. Thanks for nothing, guys. So, okay, let me throw out some underrated teams as far as I'm concerned. We talked about John Tatum and Jack Victory. We talked about the Varsity Club. Japan, Ricky Choshu and Animal Hamaguchi. One of the greatest working tag teams of all time. When Choshu jumped to Baba from Inoki's group, Giant Baba made the decision that he didn't believe Animal Hamaguchi was a main eventer, so he substituted Animal Hamaguchi for Yoshiaki Yatsu, who had the Olympic credentials. And Animal Hamaguchi's career really never recovered, but the guy was an amazing, amazing tag team wrestler. They invented the spike pile driver coming off the top rope and were very, very innovative. Now, in a completely different direction from Choshu and Yatsu, boy, are these guys... here we go. We talk about great tag team acts, a team that I've had a chance to see on videotape, and I can't believe they didn't get over more. I know they came down to Florida, Barry, and I know they didn't get in the main events, but I really was entertained by their stuff in Memphis, and that is the Blonde Bombers, Wayne Honky Tonk Man Ferris, yes, and Larry Latham. They were tremendous, and I can't believe that they didn't get a bigger push in Florida. What do you remember about their days in Florida?
Oh, they were, you know what, that's a hot, yeah, they could be on my list as well, absolutely. They were good. I think what happened with them was they didn't get a big push. They were out of this state fairly quickly, too. And have you ever heard the story of what happened with them? I don't know if I know we don't have a ton of time. We're already like an 8-hour show, but they were, I guess they had given their notice, and somebody got in their ear and said, you know, you guys are going to get your ass kicked, that when you give your notice to Eddie Graham, he's going to turn a shooter on you in the ring. And they basically packed their bags in the middle of the night, and they got out of the state. And that was it. They never came back.
Hmm. And boy, if you see some of the promos that they cut in Memphis, they were just really, really tremendous. Let me go my top three most underrated team. Here's a team that time forgot from Southeast in Alabama, Arn Anderson and Jerry Stubbs, Mr. Olympia.
Wow, great.
Great team. Number two, the original Hollywood Blondes. Barry referenced them earlier, Buddy Roberts and Jerry Brown, with their manager, Sir Oliver Humperdinck. These guys headlined Los Angeles, Montreal, Florida, everywhere they went. They were tremendous. They were, here again, great act, but they were a great act. It was a great team. They were fantastic. And my number one choice for the most underrated tag team of all time, a team that nobody remembers, or I shouldn't say nobody, that a lot of people don't remember. If you do it yourself a favor and go to YouTube and see if you can find some of the stuff these guys did, Dennis Condrey and Phil Hickerson. Let me tell you why these guys were a great tag team, because I went to Bobby Eaton one night, at a show. And I said, Bobby, let me ask you something. Which version of the Midnight Express was the greatest tag team of all time? Was it you and Stan Lane or you and Dennis Condrey? He looked at me without even thinking. He said, the greatest tag team of all time was Dennis Condrey and Phil Hickerson. And Bobby Eaton is a Hall of Fame tag team wrestler. So by God, boom, if Bobby Eaton says it's true, it must be true. I will also mention, just for clarification, the Phil Hickerson, David Schultz team. After I had a chance to listen to David Schultz on a couple of shows, the 605, and he made it a couple of appearances on other shows. He's, by the way, a great entertaining guest and can still talk a blue streak. They're a great tag team, but my choice for the most underrated tag team of all time is Condrey and Hickerson. So now, Barry, it's time for us to go to our...
If I can quickly say...
Oh, sure, go ahead.
I actually saw Condrey and Hickerson. You're right, as an underrated tag team. And I think what happens is they were strictly just in an area. I saw them in Knoxville in 1978. They were the Southeastern Tag Team Champions, and we were there for the WFIA fan convention. They were the tag team champions, and Ron Wright was their manager. And they could have gone national. Again, if you were to take those two guys, Phil Hickerson was so great. And his career was cut short with the brain tumor and things, and he came back then, but he was never quite the same. But those guys could have gone to the NWA and just fit in perfectly. A fantastic tag team. Great choice.
Yeah. Okay. So now, Barry, we are getting a little short on time. Real quick, give me your top 10 tag teams of all time.
Gotcha. So my top 10, Steve Kern and Mike Graham, Bob Roop, Bob Orton Jr., The Midnight Express with Dennis Condrey, The Hollywood Blondes with Sir Oliver Humperdinck, so I'm talking about Buddy Roberts and Jerry Brown, The Original Assassins, Joe Hamilton and Tom Renesto, Mr. Saito and Mr. Sato, obviously honorable mention to Koloff and Patterson and Koloff and Saito, The Miracle Violence Connection, Terry Gordy and Steve Williams, The Briscoe Brothers, how could we not mention the Briscoe Brothers, one of the great teams for close to 20 years, Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson. And my number one choice for greatest tag teams of all time, it's a tie, but there's a common denominator, and that's Ray Stevens. Is it Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson, or is it Ray Stevens and Nick Bockwinkel? And I'm actually leaning towards Ray Stevens and Nick Bockwinkel. I saw them when they were here in 1972 in Florida, and I was young, but I remember how good of a team that they were. And then I saw them, I saw video footage of their stuff in the AWA. They were fantastic. So that's my choice. And I think my top 10 is like my top 13. So, yeah.
Yeah, a little cheating there, Barry. I don't want to say anything, but
sorry.
You know.
Yeah.
So, okay, real quick, let me give you my top 10. In no particular order, we have mentioned already Chigusa Nagoyo and Linus Asuka were an absolutely fantastic tag team. And I really hope, I got to say here, folks, I know a lot of you guys out there are listening and you're like, first of all, you got a problem with the Japanese wrestling. You don't want to listen to the Japanese announcers. I get that. And to make it worse, some of you have become influenced by what you see. You know, like you think of women's wrestling as being moolah or even some of the stuff in the WWF with Charlotte Flair. Linus Asuka and Chigusa Nagoyo and their feud with Dump, Bull Nakano, and then later on as you got into Aja Kong versus Akira Hokuda and Manami Toyota, Toshio Yamada, and ladies like that, unbelievable. And if you've never watched this stuff, if you've never taken a chance to go outside the box and check out these women, you're missing something and you're avoiding the chance to be a true wrestling fan because they're absolutely fantastic. The greatest favor that Dave Meltzer ever did to me back in the day was turning me on to the Japanese women because they were utterly fantastic. Okay, real quick, some other choices here. The Masked Assassins. First tag team I ever saw in my life was Bobby Shane and Doug Gilbert against the Masked Assassins, Savannah Civic Center, and they were absolutely incredible. Let's go, wait a minute, real quick. I got a couple other choices here. You didn't mention, no one has mentioned on this show, holy crap, Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog.
Wow.
How did we manage to go this entire show and not mention those guys, for God's sakes? Ricky and Robert, the Rock and Roll Express, an amazing, amazing tag team. Bruiser Brody and Stan Hansen, amazing tag team. I also, Barry, have checked off Stevens and Patterson, Stevens and Nick Bockwinkel, two amazing teams. Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton, my top three, depending on the day, you know, we talk about movies and how our choices can flip. My top three are Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton, Jack and Jerry Briscoe, and Dory and Terry Funk. Those three teams, to me, are the absolute gold standard for what the tag team division is all about. A team like the Young Bucks or the Golden Lovers, as great as they are now, can only aspire to be as great as Jack and Jerry Briscoe, Dory and Terry Funk, and Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey, who are all amazing Hall of Fame talents. Barry, we're getting pretty close to wrapping up. You got anything more you want to say, my man?
No, this has been a lot of fun. You know, we've only done a couple of episodes that have been pure wrestling, but this was actually a great look at tag team wrestling. And, you know, when I was a kid, too, I think the big thing for me, I used to love tag team wrestling. Singles matches were fun, but if you had a tag team match, I was always looking forward to it. And one of my favorite matches was the Texas Tornado match, where all four men would get in the ring and fight at the exact same time. So this has been a lot of fun. I hope that people enjoyed listening to it as much as you and I actually enjoyed speaking about it.
You know, you mentioned Texas Tornado match, and now I'm sitting here thinking somebody out there is going, they haven't talked about the Von Erichs yet. So
yeah, we haven't. Yeah. They were super over. Look, they were a good tag team. You know, I don't. Yeah,
and when they hit their stride with the Freebirds, that's really what made the Von Erichs. Let's be honest with you, but they were huge stars, no question about it. So, and by the way, I will give a special shout out. Barry, can I say what our next show is going to be? Have we made the commitment to finally doing the second special edition in a row?
So we're going to have to do it again. This has all been on me. But yeah, the next show, yes, it's just
okay.
Announce it. I'm committing to it. It's here. It's being recorded. Go for it.
Episode 29 next week, we will feature Unsolved Mysteries and Murder, our top five, guaranteed to fascinate folks. So on behalf of Barry Rose, I hope you've enjoyed listening to our choices for the greatest tag teams of all time. I'm sure you're out there saying you're both complete idiots because you forgot this team. Guess what? We'll have to live with that. So I hope you've enjoyed this show, folks. I encourage you to follow me on Twitter. Tweet me and tell me who I forgot about at hashtag Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Special shout out and thanks to our man, the great Brian Last, who, by the way, did not offer his choices for the most underrated tag teams. TGBL, what are your choices, my man?